Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, committed to helping families across America pursue their college savings goals on the web at putnam.com/529. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's a global economy, which means the European debt crisis is kind of our crisis, too, right? How do we get here and what happens next? Also, water skis on fire and how to increase your gas mileage. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Allianz, providing investment, insurance, and retirement solutions through its affiliated companies in the U.S. since 1896. AllianzUSA.com. Marketplace Innovation Reporting is supported by the 2011 Jaguar XJ. Learn more at a local dealer or at JaguarUSA.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Tuesday. It's the 13th of September today. You could probably, if you wanted to, create a chart of American economic news coverage the past, what, year or so, I'd say, and it'd go a little something like this. A lot of stories about the U.S. budget fight, then the European debt crisis, then the debt ceiling thing, then the European debt crisis, then the jobs bill fight, and then the European debt crisis. Point being, one of those stories keeps coming back, and not necessarily in a good way. There is a fresh case of euro-induced jitters today. Everybody from global banking executives to political leaders are alarmed about the eurozone's failure to get its debt dilemma under control. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon explains that we have been this close to the edge with this crisis before, but not this close.
Europe has seen this coming for years. Sir Howard Davies is the former deputy governor of the Bank of England. He says it all came to a head when the shaky mortgage-backed securities that the U.S. had exported to European banks helped push some nations to the brink of default.
The initial crisis began, of course, way back in 2007 in subprime lending in the United States, then rolled forward from being a financial system crisis into being a fiscal crisis in Europe. Partly because governments, of course, took the strain, provided funding to keep the economies going, and then they ended up with large amounts of debt. And that problem is one they find extremely difficult to resolve.
Many European governments could ill afford those bailouts when they'd already been spending extravagantly and creating their own housing bubbles and other financial troubles, particularly in Greece. Michele Boldrin is an economics professor at Washington University in St. Louis.
Some of the problems have purely to do with the fact that the Greek government and public expenditure is completely out of control, and they haven't been able to bring it under control.
Which continues to breed fear that European banks could be on the hook for billions in loans they made to Greece. At the University of California at Berkeley, economics professor Barry Eichengreen says there's a catch-22, though, as Germany presses for further austerity measures.
Greece is being told cut domestic spending. They stop spending, firms stop producing, the economy shrinks, and the government's revenues go down even faster than anticipated.
Eichengreen says that's created a fiscal spiral with no easy solution.
The markets have already concluded that there is going to have to be more help for Greece and possibly the other southern European countries to enable them to get growth going again.
Today, the markets seem to find reason for hope in Germany's determination to prevent a Greek default. Professor Michele Boldrin is also hopeful but realistic.
You know, forecasting when humans are in the middle is always complicated. When those specific humans are politicians of a very different nation with huge conflict of interest, it's even more difficult. It is impossible.
Stay tuned. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Stay tuned, he said. So tomorrow on the broadcast, part two of our little economic saga from Europe, what happens if? The U.S. Census Bureau released a ton of data today on how families are faring in a still soft economy. And the headline number, more than 15% of Americans live below the poverty line, paints a gloomy picture of post-recession America. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
The Census Bureau's Ed Welniak delivered today's news like any good statistician. No emotion, no opinion.
The 2010 official poverty rate increased to 15.1%, and the number of poor increased to 46.2 million.
Brookings Institute scholar Ron Haskins isn't a statistician.
I see no reason for optimism in any of these numbers.
Haskins says the latest recession took a big toll. Poverty is now at its highest rate since 1993, and median income has fallen almost 6.5% since the downturn began.
When you're living in a country with poverty going up, income coming down, and health insurance coverage flat or declining, it's a problem.
But one of the most striking things in today's report is the hidden poverty. More households are doubled up now. In many cases, that means adults in their 20s and 30s living with mom and dad. The government figures that 45% of those young adults would be in poverty if they weren't under their parents' roof. Timothy Smeeting is a poverty expert at the University of Wisconsin.
Unless we find jobs for these adults, we risk a new underclass of younger, undereducated adults, mainly men who are jobless, can't become economically independent, buy houses or reach the middle class and all of that.
Smeeting says today's numbers would have been even worse without government programs like unemployment benefits. But he says the real solution to poverty and dwindling incomes is still jobs. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, good enough. I suppose we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Dateline Columbus, Ohio, Associated Press. Quote, President Barack Obama is challenging Congress to pass his jobs bill immediately, asking lawmakers, what on earth are we waiting for? End quote. So that's basically the state of things as Mr. Obama stumps for his $450 billion plan. It's all paid for, he says. He wants to limit some income tax deductions for companies and for families making more than $250,000 a year. Politics and economic reality being strange bedfellows, though, we asked Marketplace's John Dimsdale to find out what that might really mean.
One way the Obama plan pays for new jobs is by limiting the deductions wealthy people can claim on income from municipal bonds. That's one way local governments pay for parking lots and sewer projects. But investment advisor Richard Shaw at QVM Group says if municipal bonds are less attractive to wealthy investors, states and cities will have a tougher time raising money.
That results in either the cities having higher cost of funding, which means certain projects won't get funded, or local property taxes and income taxes will go up to pay for it.
The result, he says, will be fewer jobs created. Capping deductions the wealthy claim on charitable contributions could also have unintended consequences. Diana Aviv heads Independent Sector, a coalition of 600 nonprofits. She says those organizations could take advantage of the president's payroll tax incentives to hire more people, but not if they lose contributions from well-heeled supporters.
The fact that you give us tax credits or tax deductions that we can take off the payroll tax is good and well, but doesn't work if we don't have the cash with which to actually invest in these new jobs.
But Brian Deese with the White House's National Economic Council says those charitable and municipal bond tax deductions are windfalls for high-income people who'll donate or invest anyway.
The evidence shows that setting the maximum deduction at those levels will not materially reduce charitable giving or investment in tax-exempt bonds. And in fact, the last time the amounts the wealthiest Americans could deduct was reduced, individual charitable contributions actually rose.
Deese says when the economy is performing well, the wealthy are more likely to invest or contribute, whatever the size of the tax deduction. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
If you go to the doctor for a sprained ankle, it's an entirely different thing than going to the doctor for, say, the flu. Not so much different for you and me. We just want to get better. But it's very different for your doctor's bookkeepers, who fill out insurance forms not with an actual description of your ailment, but with a number, a code that corresponds to whatever's wrong with you. This does sound like a boring thing for us to be talking about, but in truth, it's actually kind of a funny story. Anna Matthews wrote it up in the Wall Street Journal today. Anna, good to have you with us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
I sort of can't believe I'm asking this question, but what's going on in the medical coding world? It's a little crazy.
Well, what's happening is that we are moving to a new coding system. It's going to start in 2013 that expands the number of codes from around 18,000 to around 140,000, and there's a whole lot more detail there.
I imagine so, 18 to 140,000. Let's remind people what these codes are. They're on the forms that your doctors fill out when they see you.
Yes. They're not codes that you would typically see, but it's in the claim that your doctor or your hospital would send to your insurer. And that's how medical providers talk to insurers. They send them these forms with lots of numbers that say exactly what they did and exactly what the diagnosis was that the patient had.
And you can see the need for these, but there's a level of detail that you write about this morning, and I chuckle because I was actually laughing when I read the piece. And I'm going to read a couple off here. You ready?
Sure.
Favorite one of all time? V91.07XA, which is, you say, a burn due to water skis on fire. I mean, really?
Really, it is in there. You can look it up, as they say.
But why?
I'm not sure I have a good answer for that. The code set was developed by the federal government, so you'd have to ask them. But the suggestion I had from a coding expert was perhaps it was a code for trick skiers who are going through hoops of fire. That's the best we could come up with.
All right, so here's another one. W22.02XA walked into a lamppost, initial encounter, or W22.02XD walked into a lamppost, subsequent encounter.
Indeed. And in fact, there's a third code for walked into lamppost sequela, which means sequels or further follow-up visits.
You're making that up.
I am not making it up. There are three walked into lamppost codes. It must have been a very severe encounter.
Must have been, right? And, and entirely sober, I'm sure. You talk to people who do this stuff for a living, and granted there's a need to track this stuff and make sure we know what's happening in a public health sense. But why this level of detail?
Well, what the federal agency said when I talked to them was it will lead to better tracking of what's actually being done, which is good for research. From a public health perspective, what they said is it's helpful to be able to know where injuries occur so that public health researchers can work on ways to prevent them.
Is this going to do anything to make healthcare cheaper or more efficient?
It depends on who you talk to. There is an argument that having more detail in these medical claims could lead to improved payment strategies because insurers and the federal government, which pays for a lot of health care, will have a better sense of what exactly it is paying for.
Yeah, and in all seriousness, I mean, data codes are serious stuff when you start getting to electronic medical records and transmission of information and all that stuff.
It's very important. And it's also how your insurer knows, as I said, what they're paying for and what's going on with you. So one interesting side effect is insurers will probably get a lot more information about their members, about patients. You know, you mentioned the water skiing code, but my insurer might never have known in today's world that I was a water skier. But now they might be able to see in the coding and the bill that they receive that I received an injury while water skiing.
And maybe I'm going to have to pay more for my insurance. Hello.
You never know. Starting in 2014, we're not supposed to pay more based on our health status. But until then.
Anna Matthews from The Wall Street Journal. Anna, thank you so much.
Thank you.
There's been a fairly consistent truth about retail ever since the economy started coming back, slow as that's been. The high end, land of Neiman Marcus and Bloomingdale's, has been doing a lot better than the low end. So today, Target showed off its strategy to mine the middle ground. Missoni, the super luxury Italian fashion house known, I'm told, for its zigzag prints, unveiled a new line just for Target. Crazy popular. Shoppers loaded up on laptop covers, clothes, even furniture, crashed the whole Target website, in fact. Marketplace Jennifer Collins has more.
Lila Foster and Brandy Emma are young, artsy types who live in L.A. and care about fashion. They were in line at Target this morning before 8 a.m.
When they opened the doors, people ran, grabbed anything they could grab to shove in their basket. And then the early birds proceeded to group together and do trades.
Missoni designs usually sell for hundreds of dollars. Target was selling Missoni ballet flats for $30. Foster and Emma spent about $250 each on everything from throw blankets to scarves to a
Missoni thong.
Barbara Kahn teaches marketing at the Wharton School. She says Missoni
gives new life to that Target image that they used to have. And perhaps it attracts some new people that are now paying attention to Target.
Target advertised its Missoni partnership in magazines like Vogue and Elle. Retail consultant Arnold Aronson says even low-end retailers like Target must try to attract customers with high-end tastes.
You've got to run faster just to stay even, let alone to get ahead.
Aronson says this move is about working both ends of the market.
there will be an uptick in their normal business just from the other merchandise and other parts of the stores.
Back at the store, Lila Foster was wondering
if we should buy stock in Target.
Why do you say that?
Everything was sold out in like 15 minutes.
It's good to be Target right now.
It's very good to be Target right now.
But no discount on Target shares today. The stock was up. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Coming up, saving gas and making enemies.
If everyone got 2 miles per gallon...
Okay, all right, wait. You totally missed the dirty look that guy gave me.
You know, that's their problem.
Yeah, he wasn't driving. But first, let's do the numbers. Volatile trading today ended with stocks mostly in the black. The Dow Industrials pulled up 0.4%, 44 points, ended at 11,105, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ climbed 1.5%, 37 points, finished at 2532. The S&P 500 shaved off 0.9%. That's 10 points. Closed at 1172. Aetna packed on more than 5%. Today, the health insurer says it's likely to beat its 2011 earnings forecast. That's because people can't afford much more than basic health care these days. Translation costs for them are down. Best Buy unloaded more than 6%. The electronics retailer reported a drop in quarterly profit and lowered its profit outlook for the year. Prices on the 10-year T-note fell. The yield rose to 1.99%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. And by the United Methodist Church, offering an opportunity for listeners to join others to reclaim September 11th as a day of hope at RethinkChurch.org. Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Deluxe Corp, a marketing resource to 4 million small businesses with logo and website design, search engine marketing, and more at deluxe.com/marketing. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for August. The Commerce Department reports on retail sales for August. And the House Committee on Education and the Workforce examines what role the federal government should take in ensuring student performance at public schools across the country. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, that's American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. When the revolutions happened this spring in the Middle East, more than 1 million people crossed borders from one country to another, either to get away from the fighting or to find new work. Europe saw that happening and braced itself for a flood of refugees that never really came. In the end, only 50,000 people or so wound up in Europe, half of them from Tunisia, and most of them living in France. Marketplace's Stephen Beard went to Paris to see how they fared.
Protest in Paris after police arrest dozens of Tunisian migrants. Since more than 1,000 arrived here in the spring, hundreds have been detained, many deported. Not quite the reception they were expecting, says Tunisian-born French lawyer Samia Maktouf.
That's one of the reasons that they decide to come here, to see liberty. The first sentence they have on their mouth when they arrive and when I talk to them is France Liberté.
But after the toppling of their dictator in January, they have freedom back home. Tariq Benhiba runs a Franco-Tunisian association here. He says the migrants' reasons for crossing the Mediterranean and entering Europe illegally are mainly economic.
They cross the sea to try their luck,
to make their dream reality, a dream to be better, to have a job, to get money.
6 months on, it's still only a dream. Denied permission to work, the migrants have run out of cash. In this small cafe, the migrants get free food and free internet access, all paid for by the Paris authorities. Until last week, the city also provided 300 beds a night. That largesse has come to an end. Many now sleep on the streets. But most, like 24-year-old construction worker Mohamed Toussi, are determined to stay. He says the economic situation in Tunisia is still negative. Why go back? If it were positive, he says, he would have stayed. He would not have come here. The French government has offered to fly the migrants home and give them 300 euros each, about $420. 17-year-old welder Issam Massoudi isn't tempted to take up the offer. They offer us 300 euros to leave, but we spent 2,000 to come, he says, and they offer us 300 to go. You know, many Tunisians died making this journey. They died at sea. The migrants, French supporters say, they should be allowed to stay and work. Their remittances back home would help support Tunisia's transition to democracy. But the French government is unmoved. Jacques Miard is a deputy with the ruling centre-right UMP party.
France has clearly said that those who come to our soil without any permission as illegal immigrants will be sent back home.
The French economy is in a mess, he says. Unemployment is running at almost 10%. France cannot afford to allow in thousands of migrants to compete for jobs. And it's not just an economic issue.
I don't know if you know how to make mayonnaise.
Achieving social cohesion, he says, is much like making that French sauce.
You do it by mixing, mustard, eggs and oil slowly. It's the same thing for the immigration.
He says a sudden influx of many thousands of migrant workers would be a recipe for social disaster. But by tightening border controls in response to the Arab Spring, refugee groups say France and the rest of Europe have shown only fear and a narrow economic self-interest. And that may not win many friends in the Middle East's newly emerging democracies. In Paris, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
There was an interesting chart of crude oil prices versus gas prices that I saw online this morning. The crude trend is down the past couple of weeks. Gas is most definitely not. So the other day, we invited this guy over to go for a drive.
I'm Rance Russo. I hypermile.
Hypermiling was quite the thing back a couple of years ago when gas was $4 a gallon, maximizing your mileage by changing the way you drive. Regular unleaded, still not cheap. So the other day, Rance rode shotgun in the Rizdahl family wagon, a 10-year-old minivan with just over 150,000 miles on it as of right now, to see if I've got a future as a hypermiler.
All right, here we go. Little engine goose right there. And
a little bit
boom.
Too much. You don't need to. You always want to be gentle with the accelerator.
All right, here we are. Taking a left out onto 2nd Street out of the garage. There's some traffic.
Nice and easy.
Nice.
So you're doing well.
All right.
Now you have a stop
light. I do.
Coming
they're
up
lights
here.
Red.
Take off the gas now. All right.
That's like a mile away.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
But watch though. Watch. You'll coast right up to it.
This guy in the Corolla behind me is not at all happy.
The key to all of this is just to minimize the amount of braking that you have to do. If everyone got 2 miles per gallon.
Okay. All right. Wait. You totally missed the dirty look that guy gave me.
You know, that's their problem. But I was going to say, I did some calculations last night, and I computed that if everyone got 2 miles per gallon
more. Right.
Every year we would save over 11 billion gallons in fuel. And that's approximately to 1 month's use of the entire U.S.
All right, green light. A little faster than that? All right. I'm just trying to be,
And you always want to keep the 2 on your tachometer.
Right.
Try and keep the needle below that.
Now, is that as you get going or always?
As you're accelerating.
Okay, all right.
And you're doing well.
Kind of boring. It's kind of boring. We should probably have a conversation at some point about extreme hypermiling versus common sense hypermiling.
Right.
Right?
Yep. So extreme hypermiling There's some people out there, they take off ramps at very high speeds, you know, to maintain momentum. They take turns at very high speeds to
turns keep like their, highway turns, not
keep
like
their, you know, even normal turns, you wow. know, keep their momentum up. There's drafting trucks.
What is that? Part. What do you mean?
You get behind a truck, you get right. in its slipstream. It increases your miles per gallon a whole bunch. If you get up too close, however, the micromanaging of the throttle and whatnot actually make you use more gas.
Yeah, not to mention the whole tailgating thing.
Right, and which is illegal.
Yeah.
Which is illegal. Yep.
All right, so here's the two on ramp.
Okay.
Now is this downhill?
Yeah, it is. So my foot's off the gas, right?
Okay, and then so build up your speed now.
Oh, all right.
Wait for this higher grade right here to
Dude,
start
you're
building
making
up
me tense.
You gotta
all
get
right.
the highway speed.
All right. We are now in an uphill. Speed's coming off.
But don't let it get below where you were at before.
You're killing me. Do this, do that. Don't let it get too fast. Don't let it get too slow. All
right,
this
right.
is hard.
It's hard. It's very hard. You know, it's a lot easier to do when you're not, you know, going up a huge hill like this.
Also, easier to do when there's some guy not keeping an eye in the passenger true. Seat. I'm just saying.
And another thing, too, you know, we're heavy. We have people in the car. You
but,
know, it's a
but
heavy
this
car
is
li- and everything.
This is
so.
Life, right? I mean, I schlep, you know, six people
right,
around
right,
in this car.
Right, right. I'm saying so sometimes yeah. you can't, you know, do this.
Now, riddle me this. Do you hypermile to save the planet or do you hypermile to save money?
I started doing it when prices got really high. You know, I want to see what I can do with it. Obviously, it's a little bit annoying at times. I know.
A little bit.
When you have to fill up, you know, one less time a month, you know, you start to think, well, this might be worth it.
Mm-hmm. So we're on a big, fat downhill. It's going to go for another mile.
So
there we go.
Yeah,
so I'm off the gas, coasting down. This is good. I mean, you know, I haven't touched the gas in like 90 seconds, and we're still doing 60 miles an hour.
Yep.
Oh, look at that. Tachometer still under, too. Good deal.
What you just did right there was perfect technique.
There you go.
There you
see?
Go. That's how you do it.
20
you
minutes know. Later, I know what I'm doing. If you want a hypermile without Rance Russo sitting next to you, there's a how-to guide on our website, marketplace.org. He was a good guy. Gotcha.
Marketplace is supported by CSX, transporting 2 billion pounds of goods to market by train and working to help move the economy forward. CSX, how tomorrow moves. By Reputation.com, helping small business owners, professionals, and executives monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, Elizabeth Warren is sick and tired, and she's not going to take it anymore, so she's going to run for the Senate. Warren, the Harvard Law professor who set up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau for the White House but never officially got the job of running it, is set to announce her candidacy for the Senate tomorrow. She had a frosty, one might even say testy, relationship with congressional Republicans during her stint in Washington. So she wants to go back. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow pulled up 0.4%, 44 points. The NASDAQ up 1.5%. That's 37 points on that particular index. The S&P 500 shaved off 0.7%, about 10 points. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay, Jolie Podokas, and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time, back here, a 20-something's take on today's job market.
I often feel that I am overqualified for the jobs I'm applying for, which may be one of the reasons I'm not necessarily getting them.
A generational look at being jobless in America. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, that's American Public Media.